Research presenter of the conference, Alex Caravan, joining us remotely. This year we are doing research presentations in triplets in one single session. So Alex will be the first. And again, we've got note cards at the back of the room. So if you do have questions, go ahead and get a note card. They'll get it up to me so I can ask Alex via the interface here. So I'll let Alex take it away.
I'll try to follow Trump's announcements on the coronavirus with some presentation on baseball. So here we go. Swing adjustments, which I worked on with David Besky, my colleague at Driveline Baseball. And initially, what I wanted to do was kind of do a couple of things. I kind of got a little bit ahead of myself initially, but the idea is there's been a lot of research in general done on hot and cold zones, but when I really looked into it, I felt like a lot of it was more abstract. People talk about there being holes in someone's swing, or someone used to be susceptible to a pitch and now is no longer. But three main questions that I didn't think were concretely answered in current sabermetric research were: A, how to define a hot and cold zone, whether that's a quantitative measure of someone's performance, does it have to last for a certain amount of time? Is it based on that player's own talent level relative to league or intra relativity? Is that player performing better in one zone relative to their overall zone performance? Second question, how to identify a change in the hot and cold zone, or hot or cold zone, I should say. And third question, are certain players more liable to change and kind of flip between a hot and cold zone? So again, initially I was more ambitious in thinking that I could pursue this later on as seeing what kind of adjustments people most commonly make to fix said holes. And that's still a potential area of interest, but I felt focusing on these three main questions was the most conducive. So like I said, there definitely has been some past research. Here we, the great Mike Fast in 2011 talked about being able to split the zones in a 3x3 grid and a 2x2 grid and kind of comparing which one was more reliable. And factors he considered and controlled for were heinous of the batter, the count, the catcher target, as he demonstrated that based on where the catcher sets up, a certain ball is more or less likely to be called a striker ball. And he found initially that 2x2 grid splits were more reliable, which is somewhat intuitive, right? The samples are larger, and maybe batters think of zones as larger subsections rather than the more discretized 3x3 grid, but also a little bit potentially less helpful since technically in a 2x2 grid, every single grid borders the very center of the plate. So here I'll flip through a couple more past research. Here is Jared Cross, pretty recently, I think in 2019, where he used some GAMS or general additive models to kind of model where a strike zone is by count and by hitness of the batter. In these graphics, we have the blue line where basically a call is a coin flip on whether it's a strike or ball. So at a 50% chance of a strike, you can think of it as. And then the inner red dashed line is a 25% chance of it being a call to strike. And then the outer one is 75%. And yeah, you'll see smaller O2 strike zones in the upper right, and then larger ones, larger 3-0 strike zones in the lower left. This is somewhat intuitive and it's kind of accepted as common sense or fact, but nice to see a very discretized quantitative depiction of it. And then more interestingly, when we really get into how to define a zone, there's a really interesting paper that I don't want to get too into the nitty gritty here. I put kind of an equation just for the very technically inclined, but there have been studies done on whether or not even a rectangular shape is a zone. And here David Hunter in 2018 talks about, he initially started his paper looking at analyzing umpire biases based on, certain zone tendencies, but I think it's very valuable for depicting just different ways of thinking about a zone. And in this image, it could probably a little bit confusing, but He depicts it as a convex hull, with alpha being a bandwidth showing how quickly you should or you'd close or not close the hull. And there's a couple different alpha values here. They flip from 0.4 to 0.9, and usually he settled at 0.7 being a good value. Here we'll move on to something pretty relevant to one of the methods I use in this in my paper, but this is a 2010 paper by Bammer and Dragicescu. But the idea here is they actually used two methods, that one of which I rely on quite a bit in my paper. One is the Krigging method, which I'll cover in more detail, and the other one being a kernel density estimate. And the paper kind of goes through a couple examples and shows pros and cons of both methods. Here, actually, on the left, the Tadis and Thames hot zones are both pretty agreeable across both Krigi and the kernel density estimate, while here we have Jose Reyes kind of get a little bit overfitted with the kernel density estimate, which happens sometimes when you don't choose an appropriate bandwidth. Since if you look closely, he has a couple hotspots, and yeah, he has a couple of smaller hotspots around here, which are probably not actually an indication of his battery ability, but rather just where the kernel density estimate got overfit because of smaller samples around that zone. And then we're going to swivel over to the research paper that is probably most influential by quite an order of magnitude in my own research. And I'm only going to kind of mention it here and then go into it later in detail. But here we have Jared Cross, who I also reached out to and talked back and forth with quite a bit on email. And he's extremely helpful because this, I put his more technical paper up here, but some of his findings are also represented in Bringing the Heat, a Hardball Times article from the same year, 2014. But the idea is him also using Krigging methods to kind of represent hot and cold zones. So again, we'll touch on it briefly here and go into more detail later. But kind of overall approaching the paper, I wanted to do two general things. I wanted to be the most comprehensive possible look at all the data we can possibly gather and use, and also adjust for as many factors and controls and variables as either I think was appropriate or things I kind of wished a research paper that I read would have, or basically make way for the previous limitations of other people's works. So we tried using pretty much all the sabermetric data available from 2008 to 2019. And obviously 2015 and 2019 gets treated quite a bit differently. They have exit velocity and launch angle numbers. And the big thing as well, when it comes to looking at over a decade worth of data, is that we need to adjust for both that year and within that year, different stadiums and different like home stands, basically. Because building on the work of Gerald Schiffman, who wrote the Lurking Aaron Statcast pitch data back in 2018, we found, especially when MLB started shifting over to including EV and LA figures and calibrating their track mints for each stadium, we found that homestand corrections were a thing, which essentially is differences in calibrations across stadiums. So when we look at bringing all the, so basically what the Schiffman methods are, is we get a certain amount of pitches seen per zone, per pitcher, adjust for platoon, a couple other things, and then see what the difference is in their average movement and plate location metrics from homestand to homestand, and then adjust kind of these padded differences using a linear mixed model to adjust all the aforementioned movement and plate location and velo metrics to have everything corrected, so to speak. And we also dealt with a bunch of null values and stringer values. And what that is MLBAM kind of, especially initially, TrackMan did a mediocre job at tracking certain types of batted balls. So plenty of certain ground ball or fly ball combinations would just be padded with the same exit velo and launch angle number. So say there'd be 50 unique pairs of batted balls that had, say, 102 EV and 24 launch angle. And that would just be kind of a blanket combination for a lot of fly balls. And if you want to look at the actual numbers and proportions, I highly encourage you to check out the lurking error and Statcast pitch data. Looking back on it, I might have been worth it to include a table in here. But anyways, that was applied to all of our years, so including the pitch effects years before 2015. And on top of that, I actually used a new metric from the Hunter paper that was a normalized plate Z, or a plate location height, to adjust for batter height and pitcher height, but mostly batter height, by normalizing it to the strike zone top and bottom denotation. So we used that, and we also used run values rather than any sort of general indication of batter value. For example, the cross paper I talked about, and we'll talk about much more, uses batting average, but we used run values for a few reasons. One, it lets us use every single pitch, not just pitches that end in that bat. It's more standardized per season. And it also adjusts for all these combinations. You might have heard people reference RE288. That means the 8 base combos times the 3 out combos times the 12 count combos. And not only are we looking at the actual run value, we're looking at the run value difference. So essentially, it's how the pitch before compares to the pitch after. So basically, what position someone was put, like how someone's run expectancy changes. And the run value differences are usually centered around -0.03 to -0.05, as most baseball players are run preventing. And we'll take a look here. This is, I believe, a RE288 by Tom Tango, based on, I believe, 2010 and 2015 data. And you can kind of see here what I'm talking about if the last slide was confusing. But essentially, a way to look at it is, if you're in a 3-0 count, your run expected level is right here, 0.74. And then say you go to a 3-1 count, which is a positive outcome for the pitcher, your run expected value is now 0.67. This is for the inning. So essentially the run value difference in that case would have been -0.07, as throwing a strike and a 3-0 count suppresses the expected run value by -0.07. So this is Tom Tango's matrix based on 2010 and 2015 data. But what I did was I also built my own matrix on the last 3 years of Statcast data, as for a number of reasons, the run environment's changed quite a bit. More strikeouts, more home runs, more aggressive hitters, more aggressive pitchers. So I used this RE288 for the last couple of years, and I used the 2010 and 2015 for all the other years to essentially have each year as fitted, not overfitted, but fitted more closely to a accurate league run environment. So moving on, a quick overview of basically I couldn't make up my own mind and try tackling this in 3 different ways. I used method 1. I looked at zones, how they're defined by MLBAM. So the 3x3 grid with 4 outside zones. This method number 2, and I'll have pictures of these up in a second, was Tom Tango's heart, shadow, chase, waist, splits. And then method 3, which I'll go in quite a bit of detail once I get there, is the Krigge spatial residuals. So I concern myself less with the actual discretized grid zones and more with looking at the geospatial interaction of pitches. So that probably is confusing. And my hope is that it'll be at least 5% less confusing after I get into it, but keep my hopes up. So method 1 and 2, these are the zones I used. These should be at least, if not super familiar, somewhat conceptual. And the kind of split here is for Tango's zones, essentially, in theory, 25% of balls should be thrown in the heart zone, kind of the middle of the plate. Around 50 should really be thrown in the shadow, which really is kind of, in theory, a 50% split between balls that'll be called strikes and balls that'll be called balls. And then the chase should hold around 20-25%, and then waste should be less than 5%. So looking at method one and two, I had quite a few controls. As like I mentioned, looking through all these research papers, there are clearly a few factors that influence if something's called a ball or a strike, or what even defines a zone. So a couple of things I did. First off, I only focused on fastballs, as a few of these papers do. You know, fastball is the most common pitch thrown across like a diverse array of MLB pitchers. It's the one thrown with the most intent at landing in the zone. Other pitch types would have introduced more potential variability to account for. But both in terms of hitter and pitcher approach and strike zone size. So I only kept batters in that saw at least 200 fastballs in that season, as well as pitchers that threw at least 180 fastballs in that season. And that is to say, every pitcher that didn't throw that many fastballs, I just regressed that pitcher's performance to league average rather than give it enough weight. And for this fastball definition, I used the MLBM FT and FA classifications, which are, I think, coded as four-seam fastballs and general fastballs. And we also, you know, rather than falling victim to the selection bias and identifying only poor hitters with as having holes in their swings, we centered this performance by each hitter's own relative performance across all zones. So the each zone had a an average run value difference score that was adjusted to the hitter's overall run value difference score. So if a hitter across all zones averaged a 0.00 run value difference, which means they're actually an above average hitter, and in one zone they had a, you know, negative 0.02, which against league average might be above average, but for that hitter would have been below average. They would have had a negative 0.02 in that zone. And also in a further attempt to combat small sample sizes, we omitted zones that had less than 15 pitches in the season of interest. So here is method three. So I mentioned I'd go back to the paper, and actually this is another quick overview of the paper, as it's quite technical. But essentially what the paper sought to do was split a zone in a 6x6 grid and construct a covariance matrix of batting average as distance between those locations, between paired cell locations. So for example, you know, cell one in the top left corner with cell 36 in the bottom right corner. And then once that was covariance matrix was established, it was used in a few of these simulations that I have listed below, or the simulation methods. We had Monte Carlo simulations for, and again, this is Cross's work. So this is setting the base for what I eventually did. I have a few key differences, but he ran Monte Carlo simulations across all those at-bat combinations and found the Krigian residuals performed quite concretely the best. And that is why I decided to use a Krigian residual myself. So going a little bit more in detail on this paper, because it's very essential to understanding the methods I myself used. We built a covariance matrix to get the phi and alpha values from an exponential decay model to use in future simulations, specifically the Krigian model. So the phi and alpha come from modeling the, so here in the covariance matrix, we have distance on the x-axis and the covariance on the y-axis. And these dots, as you see, are each point of interest across a combination of the Euclidean distance between the center of the cells. Again, I know this is quite confusing. So if at all you need to refresh Cross this paper after this, I highly encourage it. It's a much easier read probably than I'm making it seem. But some players could have, in theory, 630 combinations, 36 a combo two, and some could have just one if you only saw pitches in two of the discretized 36 zones. So interpreting these results, which is probably a better use of a quick overview of this. So the phi value, 0.00162, the square root of that gives us the standard deviation in batting ability. So Cross used batting average. So since it's 0.04, We expect in a given location, if a batter hits 250, we expect two-thirds of batters to be between 210 and 290. And then the alpha, the natural log of 2 over the alpha comes out to 0.61 feet or 7.4 inches, which tells us how quickly, which tells us the half-life of the exponential decay. So 7.4 inches, which tells us one pitch in a certain location tells us twice as much information as a pitch 7.5 inches away. So I'll kind of skim through this a little bit as we're getting bogged down, I think, a little bit too much technically, time-wise, but this is creating residuals. And if anybody wants to look into it more, it's the mkrig R function in the R package fields. But essentially, the Krigi was used to predict the value at a certain zone, or a certain location, I should say, and then adjusted both to league average and that player's overall ability. So we did the same thing to begin with, split the batter zone by zone, or 6x6 zone, build a covariance matrix, fit an exponential decay model to get our own equations, and then we would build a Kriging to predict the second half residuals from our first half values. So the only difference in controls here is I kept in batters that saw at least 400 fastballs, since we have a, you know, much way more grid zones to kind of account for. And I lowered the zone count for 5 rather than 15, since again, we have 36 zones to build the covariance matrix. This is our own covariance matrix. The blue line is the same LOESS smoothing curve. And our own values are, so the 5 value is, the square root of that is around 0.01897, which means, the standard deviation of the run value differential is around 0.02, which is much lower than the batting average, because run value differentials are on a much lower scale. And the half-life is longer as well, 12.6 inches. And again, this kind of makes sense because run value differential should be much more variant than batting average. So we also did the same method that Cross used to kind of, see which of his own prediction methods did the best on. We recalculated the zone into a 20x20 grid. We also adjusted everything to league averages, and we performed Kriging on the spatial residuals with the phi and alpha values from our decay model. And here I threw in a cool graphic of what this looks like. This is Tommy Pham, first half or second half. He had wildly different performances against fastballs, even though if you look on the legend, the values seem so similar together, because again, we're looking at run value differentials. But I think it speaks to like some of the more nuanced and accurate heat maps that you can get via this method. So now looking at what actually changed. So first off, we had 3 different methods. So we kind of have to see what the situation is for determining what constitutes a change zone. So we did, for method 1 and 2, we used a multivariate linear regression to predict, using all the information we had from the first half, to predict second half performance by each zone. There's no training test split. So in theory, this overfits quite a bit, but that wasn't really my concern, because I wasn't trying to build a predictive model. Instead, I was trying to be as descriptive as possible of what direction that zone performance should be swaying in if it follows the current distribution of everything else we know about zones. And then for method 3, we actually used Kriging to predict the second half performance by everything we knew, again, about the first half. And for all of these, we kind of tested it based on weighted root mean square errors, and the weights were actually zone probabilities. The weights were zone probabilities. And we determined a change zone this was decided after quite a bit of time looking at how the whole distribution shook out and what the values were. But we determined it by a player's second half performance falling out of the bound of a root mean square error for that zone, plus or minus the standard error. So essentially, if we expect the root mean square error to be 0.01, and then the standard error is 0.01, we would classify any zone that had a difference of at least 0.02 run value differential as a change zone. So this is quite a bit to look at when looking at over a decade worth of data and three methods. So this is actually still something I haven't quite sat down and unpacked fully. There's a couple different ways to look at this, but for now, just like skimming over each method's own results, we looked at method one under the 9 subzone split, how many change zones happened by zone and by year. Method two, I think is worth mentioning or worth touching on that. I think it's pretty noteworthy that chase zones had the most change zones, which I think makes sense from a hitter pitcher approach, and Hart has the least amount of change zones. You'd think someone's performance in the very heart of the plate should be the least impacted by natural variability. And then method three, since we have quite a few grids, we actually determined a change as having as a batter that has at least 26 of a possible 400 zones, once we split the 20 by 20 grid, falling outside that range. And I think what's worth noting here on whether or not, since this is fairly arbitrary, method one, if you have at least 3 zones changed, you're a changed hitter or changed hot and cold zone hitter. Method two, at least 2. Method three, at least 26. So it seems quite arbitrary, and that's because it definitely is in part. But I'm pretty comfortable with it just from the way the numbers lined up. Since method one and method three, they have the same number of overall qualified seasons. Method two had many more qualified seasons, as it only had 4 zones rather than 9 or 400. But the overall qualified number of seasons and the numerator of changed player seasons are fairly comparable. So I felt pretty comfortable going with this. And then what we kind of more of the juicy part of the paper in my project was looking at what actually went into qualifying a hitter as changed or not changed. So anybody who fit into any of those previous method, again, at least 3 out of 13, at least 2 out of 4, at least 26 out of 400. I pulled their player season averages across these metrics. This wasn't a thorough machine learning algorithm taking into account all possible metrics. I selected a curation of what I thought would be relevant things to look at a first glance on building a stochastic gradient tree boosted model to see if any of these player season metrics impacted its ability to predict whether or not said player had changed from hot to cold or cold to hot. And I used that binary variable 0, 1, 1 if it was a change season, 0 if it wasn't. And again, looked at those metrics. And I kind of brought in the batted ball types at the last second, thinking it might account for things like, the fly ball revolution or rising popularity of launch angle and metrics like that. Players might want to change their batted ball distribution. And the good news is that despite all this, all the methods having been kind of built from different perspectives, I got similar results here. And we see here I used the variable importance function that the R package comes with, or the model gradient boosted model package comes with. And this plot, while very drab, kind of visualizes how much each variable has, how important each variable is in, predicting whether or not a hitter has changed or not changed. I trained on 3 interaction depth and quite a large range of trees that might not be, super, super important based on your own familiarity with, random forest and tree boosted models. But essentially, what importance score does is it kind of weighs how much removing said variable impacts the overall classification accuracy. So this is method one. So we see swing percentage, walk percentage, and ISO as the most important ones. Method two, ISO, K percentage, swing percentage are important ones. And method three, by quite a large gap, ISO and swing percentage. So overall, I feel comfortable in power and swing percentage being the largest indicator of whether a hitter is liable to change their zones, change from a hot and cold zone hitter, or have a zone change from hot to cold or cold to hot, or overall have enough proportions to qualify as a changed player for that player season. And then kind of wrapping up a little bit here, here's some tabular stats. Don't have any, P values or anything to go with this, but I found it pretty heartening that looking at overall player averages, swing percentage and ISO percentage also had fairly large gaps between changed and non-changed seasons. And even when I qualified what kind of change we're talking about, whether it's cold to hot or hot to cold, the kind of overall trend followed. And kind of wrapping up now, the kind of problem of introducing three different methods is we didn't really establish one exact precise method, a little bit by design. The lack of established research in this made it less the goal to have any one clear cut method, but more to introduce different things to look at and could consider, and three potential salient ways to do it. And I didn't really look at too much other things that would definitely worth looking at, like inherent pitch quality in the fastball, like making it weighing whether it's a harder, whether one hitter saw tougher fastballs in one subzone versus easier fastballs. Didn't look at how the pitch quality of the rest of his arsenal. You know, if someone has really good breaking balls, that might influence how hitters perform against his fastball. And the other thing is breaking it up by like very discretized zones kind of makes it less predictive of a pitcher's own quality. When I split up the weighted run value differences by the actual, by the actual zone and kind of like sum those up by the zone probabilities, while batters did really well, they had a 0.8 correlation with their player season WRC plus. Pitchers only had a 0.4 with ERA. I think it went up to 0.5 with FIP. Other quick things, data sparsity. 2008 had a few missing, around 30,000 rows of data missing. 2019, less hitters qualify since hitters are increasingly more platooned. So future work, I think the two highlighted in red are things I'm currently working on and things that I kind of still wanted to answer it when I first started writing this paper. Basically what the swing is on how many plate appearances, or in this case pitches, you need to see to stabilize someone's hot and cold zone value in this metric. Also looking at like specific subzones is a different when you're looking at top of the zone, bottom of the zone, inside, outside. Further things that are worth touching on as well is just different definitions of these controls and looking at actual like pitch location and quality. And I think for now, like I said, I think it's a kind of the forefront in this research field, and definitely has weight to attacking certain types of hitters in a hitter pitcher matchup and creating, you know, different and more descriptive heat maps. But like I said, primarily right now, I'm more concerned and passionate about the research side of things and want to continue to push that. So, yep, thanks a ton of David Besky. He works in customer support at Driveline Baseball, but he's actually like a really competent coder and someone that is also logging R&D hours. Thanks to Jared Cross, who again was extremely helpful and fielded emails for me across Christmas time and New Year's Eve, and as well as Kyle Lindley, Eric Javich, and Dana Coyne at Driveline Baseball, who helped me a ton with ideas and looking it over, and everyone else that came before them. And I'm actually currently in a Twitter competition with Kyle Lindley, trying to get more Twitter followers, so feel free to give me a follow, and if you're following Kyle Lindley, unfollow him. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Alex. We really appreciate your flexibility joining us virtually as well. Unfortunately, we've run out of time for any questions, but we'll hopefully see you at another analytics conference soon.
All right, great. Thanks.